are Tom and Amy Spence, and they're going to speak to us about life in a big family. Tom and Amy grew up in small families. Tom grew up in Waco, Texas, in a family of three children. Amy outside of Boston, in a family of two. They met at Dartmouth, after which they were married in 1986. They have been winging it ever since. The Spences' 10 children range in age from 29, 30 next month, to 11, 6 boys, 4 girls, 3 are married, and they're the proud grandparents to 2 small grandchildren. Most of the Spences' married life was spent in Dallas, and 5 years ago they moved to the D.C. area, and we're very glad that you did. Tom has worked in book publishing for 24 years and is an editor at Regnery Publishing. It is said that you can know the quality, I think, of parents through their children. If you've met any of the Spence kids, you will know that these two have some fantastic wisdom to impart to us today. Let's give a great warm welcome to Tom and Amy Spence. So, a happy marriage, can you all hear me, is all about division of labor. So we were trying to figure out, how do we both give a talk on this, since we pretty much disagree on everything about this. But no. So the arrangement we have is one that has served us well. I'm going to talk about the theory of a large family, because I believe that having the theory right is more important, really, than the practice. And then Amy will follow with the nuts and bolts. So you can doze off during my part, and then if you want to learn what really to do, listen to Amy. When Daryl Glick first asked me if we would give this talk, the easy job of being the MC, so those days are over, and now you have to actually think of something to say. So the original title he gave me says, I want you to give a talk on why raising a big family is easier than raising a small one. I said, well, I guess I'll say anything, Daryl, if that's what you want. But I think Daryl thought about it a little more. And the next thing I knew, the title had been changed to The Joys of Raising a Large Family. So that's what we're going to tell you about. So large families now seem extraordinary, so they must be odd. Since most people try so hard to avoid having a large family, there must be something difficult about it. But I'm here to tell you that large families are normal. Not typical anymore, but normal. If a couple live in accordance with God's design for human love, there is a decent chance that they'll end up with a large family. Not always, but there is that chance. A large family, then, is natural. It's normal, even if everyone else is blind to reality. So I would say that I don't have a large family. I have a family. In fact, I would say there's no such thing as a large family. So that's the end of this talk. Right. No, there's no such thing as a large family. There is a natural family, and there is a truncated family. In your natural family, maybe 10 children, more, maybe one child. It may be no children. A family is not like a car. Right? I can go out and I can buy a Corolla or a Suburban. I've done both. I've bought many Suburbans over the years. But human beings are different. You have a baby. You don't set out to have a girl baby or a boy baby, a blue-eyed baby or a brown-eyed baby. You don't even set out to have twins or triplets or a single baby. You just have a baby. And we instinctively know that there's something deeply wrong with the sort of new idea of a designer baby, right? So I think a child, in this sense, is a, it's like a microcosm of the family. You have a child, and you love the child that you have. You have a family, and you love the family that you have. However many children there are. Love is the basis of the family, of course, and love is not calculating. If Christ's love teaches us anything, it teaches us that. Love is self-giving. You don't calculate the cost. And since love is not calculating, a happy marriage is not the product of calculation. When you got married, now there's a certain amount, I mean, maybe we should wait a year to get married or whatever, but when you got married, there wasn't that much calculation, I'll wager, right? And if it does get too calculating, that's probably a bad sign. Now, I have tried to calculate for my children's marriages, and that's another question. They never listen to me anyway, but they've done well. So it's the same with children. Since love is not calculating, a happy family is not the product of calculation. It's not the number of children that God gives you that's important. It's the love with which you welcome them. Even if he gives you no children, that love will unite your suffering with his on the cross. Calculation kills love. It can kill a marriage. How many husbands and wives have tortured their spouses by refusing the gift of a child? You all may know people like that. Calculation not only can kill a marriage, but it can kill a family. Lots of people, including the U.S. Department of Agriculture, try to calculate the price of raising a child. It's an interesting exercise on one level, and I will let you know that the official USDA price tag for a child born in 2013 to raise him to the age of 18 is $250,000. So that's an interesting figure, but it's not terribly useful. And it's also completely misleading because when you've had a child, you know that children don't cost $250,000. Children are infinitely costly, right? And infinitely precious. One of the great things about having, though, a large family, if that's what God has in mind for you, is that it is an incredible adventure. Probably many of you have heard Jim Stenson speak. He's spoken at this conference before or read some of his books. Jim talks about picnic families versus adventure families. And a picnic family is a family that approaches life as in the way you'd approach a picnic. This is something we plan out, and it's meant to be a pleasurable exercise, right? If it rains, oh, that's a disaster. If the ants come, it's a disaster. And we measure the success by sort of how much fun we have on this picnic, right? An adventure family does not see family life that way, right? You don't know what's coming, but it's going to be, whatever it is, it might be hard a lot of the time, but it's going to be great. But the mystery of it, not knowing what's around the corner, that's what makes it an adventure. Personally, I am not a terribly adventurous person, despite what Amy might tell you. If somebody said to me, Tom, you will never again in your life leave McLean, Virginia, I'd say, oh, okay, yeah, that's fine. Can I, have some books and some music, and I'll be fine. Fine. But so having all that, man, that's probably why God gave me 10 children. Because he knew otherwise I would be an incredibly boring person. And my large family is my saving grace. A family is the ultimate adventure. It begins with entering into a perilous and irrevocable partnership with a woman or man that you don't really know, right? You may think you know that person before you get married, but in the first few months, you'll discover how little you knew about that person. Generally, it's a pleasant surprise. For me, it's all been pleasant. I don't know about it for Amy. Yeah. And then, pretty soon, you have been entrusted with a human being to take care of, who has an immortal soul. And you're supposed to civilize that little creature, educate it, form it in all the virtues, and then, on top of that, set it on the road to heaven. All the while waging a ferocious battle with yourself, right, to make all that happen. Now, that is quite a project. What bigger adventure do you need than that? Well, the bigger adventure than that is along comes the next child, and you start all over. And the thing about having children, you'll discover, is that they are all maddeningly different, right? So there certainly is a learning curve to parenting. And that is one nice thing about having a number of children, is you develop a certain amount of confidence, right? Not everything is this completely frightening mystery. But the problem is, each child is so different that just and that's what tricks you, right? You think you know that child, you know, number four is a lot like child number one, and just when you're counting on that, some quirk comes out, and it's never boring. I think it's like a mountain climber. I grew up with a guy in Waco who went on to become, well, he's a lawyer for his day job, but he's a mountain climber on the side, and he has climbed the tallest peak on every continent. So he's quite serious about it, you know, including Mount Everest. Now, I would look at that and I would think, well, you know, a mountain's a mountain. You climbed one, you've climbed them all. But he doesn't see it that way, right? And the thing is, if you're climbing all of these mountains, it's true that eventually you sort of learn the ropes, right? You know what you're doing. But each mountaintop is different, right? And special, unique. That's how your children. Each child that is born is a new mountaineering adventure. My last point in the theory of a large family is the advantage of strength in numbers. Vatican II called the family the first and vital cell of society. In a darkening world, as one light after another flickers and goes out, the family is more important than ever. In a provocative and somewhat controversial book that many of you may have heard of, The Benedict Option by Rod Dreher, there's been a lot written about that book, and whatever you think about it, Rod identifies the need for Christians to, as he puts it, to cultivate their little platoons, Christian communities that are resilient enough to survive the decay of a once Christian civilization and an increasingly hostile civilization. Well, by far, the most important of these little platoons, course, is the family. And I think it's perhaps a little easier for a large family to achieve that being countercultural. Of course, a large family is now, by definition, countercultural. And it has its own culture. Every family has its own culture, but it's maybe easier to achieve that. It happens more naturally in a large family. Because a large family has this strong gravitational pull and a strong identity. Rod Dreher writes, "Raise your kids to know that your family is different and don't apologize for it. It's not a matter of snobbery. It's about imbuing kids with the conviction that there are some things that people in our family just do not do, and that's okay. There's a legendary family in Massachusetts who have 10 children. The children are all sort of my generation. And I've known a number of those adult children, and a couple of interesting stories from them. One was that the oldest child in that family once told me in a conversation that he said, you know, some things in our family were just unthinkable. And I thought, wow, that's a remarkable thing. I would like to have that in my own family. My own life would have been much better if, to me, certain things had been unthinkable. And I guess that's what Rod Dreher is talking about. You know, there's certain things that people in our family just don't do. And I think the sense of that was reinforced by so many other people in that family, you know, unthinking the same thing. And everyone was also, you had a lot of spies watching you. Right? Another story from this family is one of the kids was thinking about going to, I don't know, some party at somebody's house that he knew was really not the kind of party his parents would like him to be at, and just not a good scene. And he knew that, but one thing that made him decide to avoid it was just the fact that he had a red pickup, red truck, and he knew that he had so many siblings around that somebody was going to see that truck parked at the family. So always somebody looking after you. But I would add to Rod Dreher's point about there are some things we just don't do, that there are some things, what we want to inculcate in our children is that there are some things that the people in our family do, right? We pray. We put others first. We give our lives to God. And to accomplish that, you want to build a certain esprit de corps. In your family, there's, again, strength in numbers. When everybody's on this project, it's more encouraging. Well, the bigger the core, the more esprit it has. So those are a few considerations about the theory of a large family, why it's good in theory. I've always found it good in theory. And now I will turn it over to Amy to tell you what it really involves.
Thank you. I want to clear Daryl's name first. I think Tom knows this because we've talked about it a lot. I do think it's easier to raise more children rather than fewer children. Hopefully I can elucidate a couple of reasons why. It's like always a fun, I look forward to this conference. I've been many times a lot now, and it's a real trip down memory lane to go into the babysitting area or into the ladies' room where there are seems like dozens of diaper changes going on, and it makes me remember so many times when I had a lot of little children, I would have a woman come up to me and say, oh, these are the best years of your life. These are the best years of your life. And my only reaction to that was like, oh, dear God, do you mean it doesn't get any better than this? You know, because to me, a lot of times it just seemed kind of wild. And I look back and I realize that those women, in the best way, were so right, and that a lot of times I think mothers don't appreciate enough what it's like to have a lot of little children around you, loving you 42 hours a day, clinging to you. It's to be that loved is a real privilege, and you when you don't have so many little children around you, you miss that a lot. So to be very grateful for that when you have that, and to be even more grateful to the two men who gave you all those children, God, your father, and then your husband. I'd like to make a few observations about what the presence of many children contribute to the life of a family, and then just to give a few thoughts about present attitudes towards children and childbearing. And I just want to begin with a short story. This was told to me, and it happened to the woman who was, for many years, directed the Camp Kitty of Texas, which was called Camp Bluebonnet. She grew up, she was one of nine children, and they lived in, I don't remember the city, but they lived in a very modest house in a very modest part of town. And she met at school a new little friend when she was 8 or 9 years old, and she went over to this little girl's house to play. And it was a very elegant house in a very different part of town that she'd never really been to before, and this sort of really captured this little kid's imagination. And she came home, and the next morning her dad was reading the newspaper, and she started telling him, giving him this blow-by-blow of her afternoon in this fabulous house. And she just told him detail after detail, and she said, "Daddy, you just can't imagine how neat this house was, how fabulous it was." And he just put down his newspaper, and he looked at her, and he said, "Well, it couldn't have been any better than our house." And she said she never forgot what he had said to her, the point that he was making to her, that wasn't what made a house a wonderful thing. And I always remembered this story. Archbishop Chaput recently described the U.S. as suffering from a national crisis of selfishness and as having unhinged attitudes towards human sexuality. And I was thinking that these are two things that a healthy family does not suffer from. Either there's lots of selfishness in any family because we all are human beings and suffer from the human frailty, but there's usually, in a healthy family, there's not a crisis of selfishness, and there are also not unhinged attitudes towards human sexuality. The family should be a deeply welcoming place because the family is an inherently hospitable institution. A family should always be very open to the arrival of new members, and the guiding principle should be, you know, always room for one more. Even the family itself understands that this means the arrival of a new member can mean loss of space, loss of comfort, loss of financial means, even loss of financial security, and loss of time in a myriad of ways. But they still have that always room for one more attitude. A family open to children is in the business of investing in souls without counting the cost. And the parent's trust in God and in his providence is unwavering. And so this is the first point, that people, the presence of many people in a home, contributes much more to the human happiness and the human flourishing of the family than material things do. And human resources are more important than material resources. Now, everyone knows this, but this is lived out before the children's eyes in a large family in a very particular and striking way. The second observation would be that in a large family, everyone, the parents and the children, develop a very clear understanding of what they really need in life and also what they don't, and they learn to need less. And chances are what they have, even the parents, oftentimes have been handed down from someone else, and they're going to turn around and give it to the next person pretty quickly. So in a way that often amused me, there's not a lot of sort of private property even in large families. Everything is just kind of fluid and moves. So there are a lot of opportunities for detachment, and that's a very freeing thing in a family. It's really a grace. And in a similar way, there are in any family decisions that are constantly being made, decisions about all kinds of things, family rules, how the house is going to be run, school, the schedule, and even say, like, you know, what you're going to do on a Sunday outing. And in a large family, there are many people to factor in. And this is all also, it's a wonderful tool in a sense, because People get very used to doing what is better for someone else. In fact, that happens almost all the time. And no one falls apart. No one falls apart when they can't have what they want or they can't do what they want. And this makes me remember Barbara Falk, who's a beloved former headmistress of Oak Crest School, that she has just a funny line. Well, she'll say, "Have you ever met a spoiled child who's happy?" And no, think about it, we haven't. That forgetfulness of self is a muscle that is flexed constantly when there are a lot of children. It's for sure flexed in any family, but it gets a really big workout. And this makes children strong and resilient, and it also makes parents strong and resilient. So there are countless opportunities to give oneself. I'll change the baby, I'll feed the toddler, I'll go to the store, I'll pick up after scouts or violin lesson, ballet, I'll mail that kid's calculus textbook, I'll take daddy to the airport. There's just all kinds of stuff going on. So the children are really genuinely needed all the time. It really is like the family farm, even if you don't have the farm. And it's so much easier, it really is so much easier to be a better parent. There are so many lessons that are very built in that you don't have to kind of look for opportunities to create them. I think in that way it's like if a family has very limited financial means, that's a challenge and can be a very difficult situation, but there are so many things about it that I think for the children, it gives the witness of the parents and the parents' self-sacrifice so much power with the children, and I think it stays with them throughout their whole life, that there are things about that that are really better than if the family has very fortunate circumstances, you're kind of sort of creating a lot of things artificially in a sense. When you say no, or lastly, a large family instills a profound sense of duty and an understanding of the importance of example. And this was funny because I was going to tell that Rudd truck story because it was a great story. But when this guy told the story, what was even kind of what I remember was funny about it to me was that this guy, well, first of all, he was kind of a wild man. He was a very good boy, but he was also kind of a wild man. So he's like really wanted to go to this party. But in the end, he had decided he was going to stay home with his siblings, and he got pizza and he organized like a talent show or something funny like that. And he just said he realized he didn't want his siblings to have that impression of him of going to this party that he was guessing might get a little bit out of hand. So he just had this beautiful sense of like, I give the best example I can to my siblings. The last reality of large family life that I want to mention is the humanizing effect of there being so many different ages and stages. And so, you know, often when the first two or three or four kind of heading into adolescence, or you're in the thick of adolescence and you're tearing your hair out, which we always were, there was always someone at a wonderful stage. There was this cute 2-year-old or 4-year-old. And I know when you start and you have a 2-year-old, sometimes they don't always seem that cute. But then when you've got like a 16-year-old, trust me, a 2-year-old is really cute. So that was a real saving grace. And I just remember so many times thinking about some older kid who was maybe sort of just driving us crazy more because you realize that you didn't know how to handle the situation and that was kind of humbling. But that, you know, you thought, I mean, I'm really ready to kill this person. And I know that the teenager's really ready to kill me and daddy, but like they always wanted to come home to see the 2-year-old, or they always wanted to come home to hold the baby. And even like a 17-year-old boy would want to come home to hold the baby. And that was just a delight. It was a really merciful thing about having so many children. Also, children, this is very obvious, but they're never alone or lonely. And we live in a culture with so much loneliness, so many lonely people in big houses with lots of beautiful things, but that don't maybe have enough siblings in their life. And Tom was pointing out to me when we were talking about the talk, saying that it's really much easier to keep the isolating effects of technology at arm's length in a household with many children, because children don't need to turn to the computer or don't feel they need to turn to the computer for company. So the person to throw the baseball with or to build the fort with or walk to town with is the person sitting next to you, the person you were just having a fight with, and now you can turn and do something fun with them. This humanizing effect of the family was beautifully captured for Tom and me by a man named Rafa Pick, who's the father of 16 children and was the man responsible for creating the family development programs. And we met him in Spain many years ago. And so if you remember one thing, I think just remember this sentence, because it was so lovely. He said that in a large family, joys are multiplied and sorrows are divided. And this is very true, the effects of hardship and misfortune are blunted. You have a small army of people to carry any burden, many minds and hearts to work on problems. When you get news, you have a ton of people to share it with, to call, etc. And most of all, you have many people to pray, and most importantly, you have many children to pray. And when you have a big problem, it's the children that you want on it, right? So those three things, the investment in souls, the always room for one more philosophy, the openness to giving oneself and this being encouraged, and the humanizing role of the family, these are, I think, treasures of life in a large family. And then a few thoughts on children and childbearing in general. To be closed to the children that God would send a couple is to miss the very best part of marriage. Children are always its crowning blessing. And when God sends no children to a married couple, he's asking the couple an even higher level of self-giving so that they can turn to those in need and give the love of a father or mother or brother or sister. A culture that encourages people not to accept children is a culture in sharp decline. A culture always reflects people's understanding of the meaning of existence, of what's important in life. And we can all see, I think, that the understanding of what's important in life and what makes people happy is largely absent from contemporary culture. Perhaps the best reason for having children, and even lots of children, is that it is hard, and it involves sacrifice. For whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his life? So the sacrifices of husbands for their wives and wives for their husbands and of parents for their children give a deep sense of fulfillment to a person that's not the same as the fulfillment given by doing things for ourselves. Love is always its own reward, and we should always be ready to lose our life in order to find it. If a couple is calculating or unwelcoming without a grave reason, they risk following Christ at a distance or not at all. Peter's described in the gospel as following Christ at a distance. Before he denied him. We can all be guilty of having what amounts to a kind of death grip on our plans, on all our plans on whatever level, our small plans for the day and our plans for the next 5 years or our bucket list for all the things we want to do in life or whatever. But God offers to each person exactly what the person needs at every moment. But the person has to accept what God offers. And loosening our grip on our control of things is a way to begin reaping the benefits and the joy of receiving what God wants to give us. A family with many children, in addition to offering a superabundance of opportunities to give oneself, offers a superabundance of memories that each person retains for the whole of his life. And if you think about it, for some people, that experience goes unrepeated. They may not marry, they may not ever have children, and so that's all the more a treasure for them. I want to close with some lines from the Brothers Karamazov on memory. And I had the pleasure of reading that book for the first time this past summer, and I drove my family crazy talking about it. Alyosha, the protagonist, is speaking to a group of schoolboys here. It's at the very end of the novel. "You must know that there is nothing higher and stronger and more wholesome and good for life in the future than some good memory, especially a memory of childhood, of home. People talk to you a great deal about your education, but some good sacred memory preserved from childhood is the best education. If a man carries many such memories with him into life, he is safe to the end of his days. And if one has only one good memory left in one's heart, even that may sometime be the means of saving him." Thank you.
Tom and Amy, thank you so much. Do we have any questions for Tom or Amy? Any questions in the back?
Hello. With the mantra of always room for one more, what are your feelings on natural family planning? And in an environment where maybe your coworkers or your friends are all getting vasectomies or using contraceptives or saying you're having another one, what's the right way to carry oneself?
I think in terms of when a couple has to make a decision about whether they've got a grave reason, which is, you know, a very serious reason why they should postpone either for a time or even permanently being open to having children, that's just through prayer, and it's good to go. It's wonderful for people to read Humanae Vitae, and to I think the point there occurred to me was that if someone makes that decision, it should be made. If you have to make it, and there are for sure reasons that people do, that it's a hard decision to make. It's not the decision that you want to make. Whereas a lot of times, that's not people's reason, really. They're totally, I say this with all so much understanding, they're exhausted, they feel completely spent, but they're just like, I'm done with that. So that it's more like what the attitude is. And then, I don't know, I regretted looking back on my many earlier years that sometimes I wasn't more forthright with people. A lot of times a sense of humor to be pray to be able to sort of make a funny remark, but to get your point across is helpful. To be truthful with people, and that, you know, to say you're risk missing the very best part of marriage, and you're just not aware of the mystery of what God's plan is. And sometimes it's don't even bring God into it, because for some people that's just not going to help them. But I think that, I don't, do you have anything else, honey?
Well, the only thing I would add is on that question about, you know, how do you respond to people who are puzzled or sometimes critical? I would say in all the years we've had a family, I could probably count on one hand the number of snotty or snide, you know, remarks that I've ever seen. Maybe Amy gets it more. Now, we get a lot of comments over the years of, you know, like amazement or like, oh, you know, whatever. But most people, I think a large family is now so unusual in certain, not in this room, you know, but when you're out there, it's so unusual, but it's also very attractive to people, you know. Unless your family's really dysfunctional, it's an incredible means of apostolate. It's just this big love machine, yeah. And people see that you're very happy. They see your children are generally happy. Now, we would generally only let Mary out in public, and she's the only one here. But no, you know, you're. People see you're happy, and that's the best argument, I think.
So when you have a large family, how do you personally help each child develop a unique relationship with God that he's calling them to? Like, what are kind of the nuts and bolts of what you and your family do every day to help them develop that relationship and a desire to develop it personally, independently of you? So when they do leave your home and go off to college and get careers, that is something that they've carried with them, and it is something that is personally desirable to them.
I think it's Father C. John's line. It was always a wonderful line, a good way of explaining things, that you want them always, you want to leave them wanting to know and learn more and not begging for less in terms of the faith. And I'm not sure we always achieved that. But, when they were little, we were both going to Mass every day since the beginning of the marriage. So that was very helpful because they always came along when they were little. They had to come because there was no one to stay with at home. And that was, I think that was just tremendously, they received a lot of grace from going. Reading, I think Lives of the Saints are lovely, and we loved all of Tommy DePaola's books because they had beautiful art. He has a lot of picture books about the Gospels and Lives of the Saints. And the kids could recite those by heart. Everyone, you know, read them to children who were younger than they were. We always tried to have as good literature as we could find. Many times there were just secular books that impart excellent wisdom and lessons about just the truth about life. What else?
Well, I think, that's a really broad question. spiritual formation of your children. And I think maybe the most important thing, there are a million different techniques and things you can do, but the most important thing is they will see what's important to you. And kids always know what's important to their parents. And, more than kind of cramming doctrine down their throats or whatever, although I like to cram doctrine down their throat as much as anyone. But they see what's important to you and what has made, you know, a generally happy family. And I don't know, so far so good with us. We'll see.
Tom, I appreciate the comment on the bigger the core, the more the esprit. I think I caught your flow in terms of the more the possible. esprit or possible happiness, the bigger a family is. Have you ever encountered families that are large and complete and lots of kids who have been deeply unhappy for a sustained period of time? And how do you find ways to encourage them if you've ever had that conversation?
Well, when we were starting out, again, I was from a small family, was not from a Catholic family, so the whole large family thing was completely new to me. And but as we started having children, I had the sense that, well, if a large family is automatically successful and happy, because all the ones that I had, met up to that point were. But it's, you know, no, it's not always the case. I would say the few that I've known of, I mean, it's usually kind of pathology. You know, somebody's an alcoholic or depression, you know, kind of clinical depression. There's something like that. And so that needs treatment. But I would say that's, you know, the exception, not the rule. And then when you do run across a family like that, well, they need help, because the difficulties become more difficult. And so it's important to be really generous with them.
Just remember that the line about the joys are multiplied and the sorrows are divided. There are a lot of, I think one of the, again, that idea of like a large family is tremendous just in-house resources. And I think God gives suffering to any family always. And I remember one time someone in our extended family sort of laughing and looking at me at one day and saying, gee, with that many children, you're going to have seen just about everything before you're done. And I thought, oh my gosh. But there are within any family, and particularly, I mean, God gives very deep suffering sometimes to families. And but a large family can also, in a sense, have certain inbuilt resources to deal with that, and that maybe smaller families don't.
Tommy, thank you so much. Can we give him a round of applause?
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.